Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Paul Kavika Martin of Peace Action, who considers the significance of the International Nuclear Framework Agreement with Iran announced last week, and the consequences if opponents succeed in killing the accord. Steve Berg of the National Alliance to End Homelessness, who talks about the state of the nation's homelessness problem, examined in his group's new report. And Akine Freechild of Public Citizen, who discusses the national campaign calling on President Obama to issue an executive order requiring federal contractors to disclose their political spending. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a seldom-seen demonstration of labor unity, as many as 90,000 workers in Vietnam launched a strike on March 26th, targeting a giant corporate footwear factory outside of Ho Chi Minh City, which makes athletic shoes for Nike, Reebok, and Adidas. Workers went on strike for a week in protest against a new social insurance law, which would have prevented workers from taking a lump sum payout when they leave a company, delaying payment until they retire. Workers have said they are concerned the money may not be there in the future. The labor action, the worst since workers damaged foreign factories following China's placement of an oil rig in contested waters off of Vietnam's coast last year, was resolved when Vietnam's communist government agreed to reconsider the new pension law. Labor strikes are rare in Vietnam, a nation that is actively courting international investors to build garment and clothing factories. Vietnam, which now manufactures 10% of the world's shoes and footwear, saw its exports increase by over 20% in 2014. While there are Communist Party-affiliated labor unions in Vietnam, many workers complain that no one represents their interests. Romania's prosecutors hit pay dirt when they found 80,000 euros, three gold bars, and a Renoir painting in a safe belonging to Finance Minister Darius Valkov, who had earlier resigned after being accused of corruption. Soon afterward, Valkov was arrested on charges of taking $2 million in bribes from a contractor working on public infrastructure in the city of Slatina, where Valkov was mayor at the time. The former finance minister is among Romania's highest-ranking public figures who have been snared in corruption investigations. Others accused of corruption include a former presidential candidate and former Prime Minister Adrian Năstase, mentor to the current Prime Minister Victor Ponta. Romania has long been viewed as one of the most corrupt countries in Europe. Recent actions taken by prosecutors to win convictions have won praise from the European Union. In the past year alone, 1,200 people have been convicted of corruption, including 24 mayors, 5 members of parliament, and 2 former government ministers. Overall, 7% of all politicians elected in Romania in 2012 were convicted or are under investigation for corruption. Lucas County, Ohio, which includes the city of Toledo, is adopting alternatives to incarcerating juveniles and referring at-risk youth to counseling, drug treatment, and other services. Judges in juvenile court conduct an assessment in each case in order to connect teens with the appropriate level of social services. Deborah Hodges, the Lucas County Juvenile Court Administrator, told the Christian Science Monitor, "You can send a kid to juvenile prison for 6 months or a year, but guess what? He's coming back. And if you have increased his criminality, then you've increased the risk to the community." In 2011, 61,000 children on average were locked up every day in the United States, either in pretrial detention or in residential facilities. This represents a 41% reduction in the juvenile population since 2001, according to the Justice Policy Institute in Washington, which supports reduced incarceration. The level of youth incarceration has dropped faster than the 30% decline in juvenile-related crime over the last decade. In 2005, the conservative-leaning U.S. Supreme Court ruled it unconstitutional to execute an individual for a crime committed before they were 18 years old. Later, it banned mandatory life sentences without parole for juvenile non-homicide crimes, and in 2012, it extended that ban to homicides. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
In a long-awaited announcement, the group of nations known as the P5 Plus One, the U.S., Britain, France, Russia, China, and Germany, revealed on April 2nd that a framework had been agreed upon ensuring that Iran's nuclear program would remain peaceful. The negotiations with Tehran, which began in November 2013, temporarily froze the Iranian nuclear program in place, while negotiators worked to hammer out a long-term agreement. The framework, agreed to by all parties in the talks, commits Iran to scale down its nuclear program over the next 10 to 15 years and submit to intense inspection of its nuclear facilities. In return, international sanctions that have badly damaged Iran's economy would be phased out over time as the Islamic Republic meets its commitments. But as negotiators work toward drafting a final comprehensive agreement before June 30th, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, along with congressional Republicans and aspiring GOP presidential candidates, have condemned the Iran nuclear deal. They charge that the accord won't prevent Iran from building a nuclear weapon years down the road, and that the lifting of sanctions will embolden the nation to make more trouble in the world and enhance Iran's regional influence. Proposed legislation that could derail the nuclear agreement is supported by most Republicans and some Democrats. Your reporter spoke with Paul Kavika Martin, political director with the group Peace Action, who talks about the significance of the International Nuclear Framework Agreement with Iran and the consequences if opponents succeed in killing the accord.
So my reading of the way that both parties, and for the most part I'm talking about the U.S. and Iran, how they played it back to their constituencies, is that they've actually come to agreement probably around 95% of the things that need to be agreed upon. And there's probably about 5%. And I'm not going to minimize that 5%. One of the things that it's clear that probably was not worked out in the negotiations is exactly when, how the sanctions will be lifted from Iran. You could look at the language that's written out that the U.S. sent around in a fact sheet, and you can interpret it a number of ways. Iran's interpretation, as they're saying it back to their constituency at home, is that as soon as the deal is signed, all sanctions will be lifted, and then that's how it's going to go. Whereas the U.S. has said that sanctions will only be lifted after certain steps are verified by the IAEA. So once they cut their centrifuges by two-thirds and maybe a certain number of sanctions, and once they get rid of 95% of their low-enriched uranium, then a certain more sanctions. So more of a phased approach. So my guess is they could not reach the exact timeline and the exact agreement on what was going on there. So they used very ambiguous language on purpose. And we're trying to sell our hardliners here, and Iran is trying to sell their hardliners over there, and they still have that to work out. There's probably several other things that are kind of like that that need to be worked out over the next 2 or 3 months. But we do have 2 or 3 months, and we're a very long step ahead to reaching a deal. Let's not forget, it's only been a couple of years that we've had any kind of bilateral discussions with this country. So we've come a long way in the last 2 or 3 years, and we're probably at the, for you football fans, we're definitely golden inches at this point.
In your view, what is the biggest threat of opponents to undermine this deal in the coming months? You have Tennessee Republican Bob Corker in the Senate, who's got a bill that would require Senate ratification of any lifting of sanctions that would be part of this deal. But maybe you can give us your take on who are the players in Washington that you think could undermine or derail this agreement completely.
Yeah, I think in the end of the day, it would be Congress, and especially this Corker bill, which on the surface says that it's meant to be an up or down vote, whether or not to support or oppose the bill, but also has other language as it stands. Some language in there says that no sanctions could be lifted for 60 to 90 days, something like that. That certainly ties the hands of negotiators if they are already thinking about lifting, you know, some minimal amount of sanctions in the beginning of the agreement. The second thing, which is I think probably the biggest deal killer, is there are some requirements for the Obama administration to certify that Iran is not funding terrorists. It's a very difficult thing to prove a negative. We know there are issues with Iran supporting Hezbollah and other things like that. That's a separate thing that we're going to need to deal with in Iran later on. That is not, should not be part of this historic deal that will make us safer in the end. So that's like the largest concern right now is Congress. Now, who's going to be pressuring Congress? Well, you do have Israel and groups that specifically support Netanyahu's stance here. In the U.S., you have some of the old neocons from the Bush administration. You've heard from former U.N. Representative Bolton, who say we should use military intervention into Iran to solve the problem, which most military experts say that's ridiculous. Not only would it cause probably a major conflagration in the Middle East, it would only set them back probably 2 years and force them to move down the path of trying to get a nuclear weapon, where as it stands, they're not doing so. So I think those are probably the major forces that need to be overcome over the next few months.
Paul, what are the consequences if Congress rejects this agreement and this accord that many people in the world are looking to avoid a future conflict, if this falls apart?
Yeah. Sabotaging this deal would just further strains in relations with our most important NATO allies. You know, this is a time when Western unity is being tested on a number of fronts. So, you know, we have the international community, we have major powers in the world, the P5 plus Germany, who are pushing towards this deal. They are not doing it, you know, just for grins and giggles. They're doing it because they do think this is a way to solve one of the largest national security threats that the world faces, and that would be Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon. And if our Congress was ended up sabotaging a deal that our president, our diplomatic corps, our Department of Energy, which included our experts at Lawrence Livermore Lab, all of our nuclear weapons experts were used to make sure that this deal would ensure that Iran would not get a nuclear weapon, any nuclear materials, with at least a year. If that was scrapped by Congress, it would just be a horrible thing. You know, it's very difficult to see exactly what the ramifications are, but they are very, very bad. And so we hope that in the day, even if something was passed, that there's no way that they would have enough votes to override a veto. But that's still going to be pressure by not only people, but people writing letters to the editor and continued media like yourself that are out there talking about this issue to educate the public to understand that this is in our best interest, that inspectors on the ground is better than boots on the ground.
That was Paul Kavika-Martin, political director with the group Peace Action. For more perspectives on the ongoing Iran nuclear negotiations, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The economic recovery in the U.S. has meant more jobs, lower official unemployment rates, and along with that, a small drop in the number of the nation's homeless population. According to a new report from the National Alliance to End Homelessness, the rate of homelessness fell by just 2.3%, and the number of people at risk of homelessness has yet to return to pre-recession levels. The downside of the recovery is that housing prices are heading upward again. The federal government defines the homeless as those without a permanent place to live, including those on the streets, in shelters, or doubling up with family or friends. For decades after World War II, homelessness was mostly limited to impoverished areas of inner cities known as Skid Row. But when the Great Recession struck in 2008, homelessness spread to include whole families with children, formerly middle-class residents of the suburbs, and many more Americans who were already barely holding their own. On any given night across the U.S., about 154,000 more people were experiencing homelessness than there were beds available to assist them. One problem is that many Americans have come to accept homelessness as a normal part of life, making it harder to imagine ending it. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Steve Berg, Vice President for Programs and Policy at the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Here he explains the good news and bad news in his group's recent report titled The State of Homelessness in America, 2015.
The good news is that homelessness is going down. Homelessness is people living on the streets in places not meant for human habitation, or people living in emergency shelters or temporary housing specifically designed for homeless people. The numbers continue to go down. We're always a little ambivalent because it's still way too high. I mean, there's still more than 500,000 Americans homeless on any given night. And although there has been investment by the federal government as well as philanthropy and cities and states all over the country really trying to focus on effective practices that really work to get people out of homelessness. We're still looking ahead, facing a very tough situation because we see rents starting to go up around the country.
Steve Berg, and two successful strategies used quite a bit recently are rapid rehousing and permanent supportive housing. Can you explain what each one is and who would be most likely to benefit from each type of program?
Okay, rapid rehousing is an intervention that's designed for people for whom the main cause of their homelessness is short-term economic crisis. So it responds to that with a short-term intervention that mainly focuses on their housing situation. So it's a program that moves homeless people back into permanent housing as quickly as possible. So it usually involves a local nonprofit who's getting funded to do this, and they work with landlords to help find housing that's available to homeless people. Then there's some help with the rent. It's usually paying for the security deposit, paying move-in expenses, and then maybe paying a few months' rent is pretty typical. And then the third piece is working with the now formerly homeless person to help them get a job and get whatever other kinds of help they need to stabilize in their situation, with the hope that by the time that several months of rent subsidy is over, they'll be able to afford housing on their own. And this turns out this works for a very large percentage of homeless people. And it has a lot to do, particularly with families with children, why homelessness didn't really skyrocket during the recession, at least as measured by the number of people in shelters and the number of people on the streets. Well, permanent supportive housing is more designed for people who do have long-term, very severe disabilities, health problems, usually behavioral health problems, people with severe mental illness, which is very common among the homeless population, people who have been homeless and lived on the streets for years and years. And that involves more of a deep, long-term rent subsidy. Often it takes place in housing that's owned by a nonprofit specifically for that purpose, although there are other permanent supportive housing models that just rent apartments from regular landlords. But then there's also a program of health care and supportive services to help deal with the very severe disabilities that people have. And this, too, has been very effective for that most hard-to-serve group of homeless people, people with severe mental illness who've been living on the streets a long time. Against most people's expectations, people like that who move into permanent supportive housing stay housed, and they actually save taxpayers a good deal of money because people like that who are living on the streets, people with severe mental illness who are living on the streets for a long time, end up costing taxpayers a lot of money in jails, in emergency mental health treatment, in homeless shelters, of course. But then once they're housed, they stop going to jail. They stop going to the emergency room nearly as much. When they're hospitalized, they don't stay hospitalized as long if they've got a place to live. It's actually a very effective program, makes an incredible difference in the lives of the people who are being rescued from the street, and saves taxpayers money. It's hard to imagine what could be better.
Steve Berg, I imagine that funding cuts the last few years have really impacted efforts to address homelessness. Is that right?
Actually, you know, even despite the overall cuts in spending that we've seen the last few years, the people in Congress who make decisions about how to allocate those cuts, they've actually tried to make sure that the homeless programs don't take a hit. The one year, 2013, which was the very worst year for funding cuts, the homeless programs did take a hit there, did get cut there. But mostly they're staying level, but that's frustrating because these programs are working so well, and it's like we see if there was a small increase in funding in order to actually meet the need, we could end homelessness pretty easily and pretty quickly. But just keeping the programs level funded is not quite enough to do that.
That was Steve Berg, Vice President for Programs and Policy at the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Access a copy of his group's State of Homelessness in America 2015 report and related news and commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. ever since the controversial Supreme Court rulings in the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission and McCutcheon versus FEC cases that opened the floodgates of unlimited and unaccountable money in U.S. election campaigns, activists across the country have been working to reverse the decisions. But short of a constitutional amendment, which requires approval by a two-thirds vote in both the Senate and House, followed by two-thirds of the 50 states ratifying the measure, progress will be incremental. On April 2nd, a rally was held at the White House and at dozens of other locations around the country, calling on President Obama to issue an executive order mandating that corporations with federal government contracts disclose their political spending. The drive for an executive order is being organized by 55 advocacy groups, whose members delivered 550,000 petition signatures in support of the measure at the White House rally. With $500 trillion spent annually on federal contracts, there's ample opportunity for corporations that have or are seeking federal contracts to secretly funnel large sums of money to influence the very same lawmakers who cast votes on awarding those contracts. Your reporter spoke with Akine Freechild, co-director of Public Citizens Democracy is for People campaign. Here she talks about why a coalition of citizens groups are working to convince President Obama to issue an executive order that requires federal contractors to disclose their political spending.
The rally we had in front of the White House is one of 50 rallies we had all over the country, people calling on the president to do what he can with the stroke of a pen to make sure that we at least know where, you know, money from federal contractors is pouring into elections, which public officials are the beneficiaries of big corporate federal contractor largesse, and be able to look and see, you know, are those officials also involved in approving contracts? Is there a quid pro quo going on there? Right now, we don't have that privilege, and barely one-fourth of the largest government contractors disclose their contributions to outside groups. That's groups outside of the parties themselves, like super PACs, nonprofits, and the like. But the significance of April 2nd is it's the anniversary of the Supreme Court's McCutcheon decision, which is another decision like the Citizens United decision, where it drastically loosened the amount of money that can be spent in our elections. So in the McCutcheon decision, which came down a year ago in 2014, there was originally a cap on how much an individual could give to parties in federal election cycle. The two-year cycle, there's about 120,000. There's only about 1,200 people who got even close to that in past years. But one individual said, I want to be able to give more. I feel like it's a restriction on my ability to spend. So you need to remove this cap. And they went ahead and did that. And now it's possible to give up to $6 million to party committees and affiliated committees in our elections, which is just a crazy amount of money. It's beyond what any average American voter could ever dream of spending. And it really changes the game, and it changes who our officials that we elect to represent us are really accountable to. So that data is really important to call out.
What are the rules governing these corporations that have federal government contracts? What kind of reporting do they have to comply with now in terms of possible conflicts of interest with their campaign spending, as well as just plain old ethical issues here?
The individuals within corporations are still subject to the same laws they were before in terms of giving directly to candidates and parties. They can form employee PACs, and those have always been are long been ways that individuals affiliated with corporations made their expenditures in our elections. But what changed after Citizens United is that those corporations can now spend directly from their general treasuries. If they're publicly traded corporations, those general treasuries must be spent to further the profit of those corporations. So you have a system which basically, on one end, you're saying, this is a for-profit corporation. We have to spend our funds to make profit. And they're giving those funds to a public entity that's supposed to serve individual citizens, not corporations. It's not supposed to favor one corporation over another. It's supposed to be a fair arbiter in the market. So it's fundamentally corrupting, and that's the problem we've had since Citizens United. And we've seen federal contractor PAC spending, which we can monitor, triple since 2004, but we don't know what their undisclosed spending is. Since Citizens United, the Federal Election Commission has steadily pulled back from some of the enforcement that they were doing, and they have not been requiring disclosure they have been making it easier, in fact, for federal contractors like Chevron to spend unlimited amounts of money to do kind of whatever they want without needing to disclose. We know about Chevron. Obviously, they disclosed their spending in this last election, but we don't know where a lot of contractor spending is going, and some of that has gone underground, and we're calling on the president to change that and make sure the public has a right to know, make sure that we do know what's happening.
I've read that an estimated $500 billion are spent annually on federal contracts. And there's got to be examples of conflicts of interest and ethical violations that could be exposed by a White House executive order to force federal contractors to reveal their spending. Maybe you could give us some examples or scenarios where a presidential executive order like this would shine the light of day on what many people would classify as corruption.
Yeah, I think some of the biggest federal contractors are defense contractors, and folks have heard a lot about Congress wanting to pass legislation to fund particular types of military equipment that we hear from the Pentagon aren't actually needed. There was a long, drawn-out debate about the F-35 jet engine, for example. Defense contractors spend over $24 million to influence the 2014 elections. That's what we know about. They received billions in federal contracts. What little we know about spending shows that the dollars that are spent to fund election campaigns seem to be rewarded with billions on millions. So the return on investment is huge if these contracts are in fact inspiring quid pro quo corruption, but we can't say that for sure without knowing. And of course, the presidential executive order would expose future spending, not past spending. So it may not tell us the story of what's been happening, but it certainly will discourage the kind of quid pro quo corruption that we're concerned about.
That was Akine Freechild, co-director of Public Citizens Democracy is for People campaign. For more discussion and analysis of campaign finance reform initiatives, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.